and good afternoon and happy Sabbath to everybody. As many of you know, I'm the parent of three children, the youngest of whom is now 25, and have been a public school teacher for over 40 years now. So with all these years of dealing with kids, there's another topic that I should be an expert on, but I'm not. I can, however, say that the experience I've had and the mistakes that I've made and some of the reading I've done over some of the recent years have taught me a lot and even changed my perspective on this particular topic. What's the topic? Discipline. For a title today, you could put Four Keys to Effective Godly Discipline. It's a huge topic, and I can only scratch the surface. But we'll start by first establishing what we mean by discipline. And we'll start with a dictionary definition to get an idea of a common understanding of the word as it's frequently used today. The Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary states it pretty well. Discipline, as a verb, to punish or penalize for the sake of enforcing obedience and perfecting moral character. Or to train or develop by instruction and exercise, especially in self-control. I found that a Bible concordance was also helpful in shaping a correct understanding of the word. If we go to the Old Testament, the Hebrew word that most closely fits our definition of discipline is musar, or at least that's the transliteration, and it's spelled M-U-S-A-R, musar. In the New Testament, it's the Greek word paideuo, with the transliteration spelled P-A-I-D-E-U-O. Both of these words, musar and paideuo, if that's how you say it, are also translated in various English versions of the Bible as correct, correction, chasten, chastise, chastening, instruction. It's frequently used that way, instruction, training, rebuke, reproof, and warning, as well as the word discipline. These are all good words to keep in mind because good discipline is a lot more about instruction and correction than it is about punishment, which we often associate with discipline. Let's notice Proverbs 6:23, in fact, I'm going to be in Proverbs for a number of verses here having to do with discipline. In the New King James Version, it reads, "For the commandment is a lamp, and the law a light. Reproofs of instruction," the Hebrew word musar there, "the reproofs of instruction are the way of life." The New American Standard Bible actually says rebukes for discipline are the way of life. So now that we've established a definition of discipline, we can establish the goal. And that's the first key of effective discipline, to understand the goal of discipline. Well, what is the goal? Well, it's not to make life easier for the parent or the teacher, although that might be a long-term side effect. For our purposes as Christians, Christian parents, teachers, summer camp staff, anybody who has a position of authority, the goal of discipline is the perfecting of godly moral character, similar to what's stated in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. More specifically, we want to instill in our young people the ability to determine right from wrong, and then instill it so well that even when they're on their own and are tempted to do otherwise, they'll still do what's right. They'll stay strong in the face of hardship. It's a pretty lofty goal, and sometimes we as adults have a hard time living up to it. But it's what we're required to shoot for. God requires us to diligently teach our children, as we just heard the announcements there, Deuteronomy 6. And if they go off track, we are required to massar or discipline them to make a course correction. We'll notice Proverbs 23, verses 12 to 14. Proverbs 23, verses 12 through 14. Apply your heart to instruction. There's that word, musar again. And your ears to words of knowledge. Verse 13. Do not withhold correction, musar again, from a child. In the New American Standard, it reads, apply your heart to discipline and your words or your ears to words of knowledge. Do not withhold discipline from a child. God expects us to discipline our children if they go off course. Now, we've got to be careful about how we interpret the next part of the verse, though, next part of verse 13. For if you beat him with a rod, I'm back in the New King James Version, he will not die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell, or Sheol, the grave. The last part of that, verse 13 and verse 14, again, deserve a little explanation. It's not talking about one-size-fits-all use of spanking or paddling for every discipline situation. Correction or punishment should fit the crime or fit the infraction. Even the criminal justice system of the Old Testament requires a punishment that fits the crime. You can think of the principle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in Leviticus 24 and equitable compensation for wrongs that are being done. Corporal punishment, spanking and paddling, those are for the extreme situations. These are the cases for which other forms of correction have been tried and failed, but are so serious that even physical punishment would be better than where the bad behavior is leading, which is, of course, death or the grave, as it says at the end of verse 14. The real point I'm trying to make with the verse, though, is that God says we are to instruct and correct our children. Apply your heart to instruction. Do not withhold correction. Also in Proverbs, if we turn to Proverbs 20, verse 15, we'll notice that God does not want what is sometimes referred to as laissez-faire parenting. Laissez-faire parenting. Parenting where there's no correction, no limits, nobody's in charge, and the parent's attitude is, well, we'll just leave it up to the kids to figure out right and wrong. And after all, there's no absolutes anyway. They'll figure it out for themselves. Well, Proverbs 20:15 shows us God's response to that sort of thinking. It says, the rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. We don't expect our kids to attain the goal of godly moral character all on their own. They need help. Second key to good discipline is proper motivation. Actually, these first two keys are closely related and probably could be interchanged. But what is the proper motivation for discipline? Let's look to Proverbs 3. Verses 11 and 12. The writer of Hebrews 12, repeats the same statement. Proverbs 3, verse 11, My son, do not despise the chastening, musar, of the Lord, nor detest his correction. For whom the Lord loves, he corrects, just as a father the son in whom he delights. God's motive for disciplining us is love. We as well have to truly love and care about the people that we're disciplining. Well, that's key number two. Be motivated by love. And I have to admit that as a teacher, for a lot of the years that I taught, my main motivation was not always love. My main motivation was to make life easier for myself. I wanted an orderly classroom. I wanted to teach without interruptions. And I remember an occasion 15, maybe 20 years ago, when a girl in class did something, and I don't even remember what it was, but it interrupted my lesson, and it really irritated me. And I loudly and very sternly chastised her, and she responded by crying. I felt bad, and I think I apologized at the time. If I didn't then, I know I ran into her maybe a year later, and I did apologize then, but when I ran into her later, the first thing that came to both of our minds was this incident. Mr. Hansen, you got so angry. You yelled at me in front of the whole class, and it made me cry. And I don't even remember what I did wrong. Not her exact words, but something close to that. But this leads to the third key. Apply discipline with empathy and not anger. And unfortunately, it wasn't until very late in my teaching career that I really understood and appreciated that. When our kids make mistakes and need to be disciplined, it's really important that limits are set and that discipline is administered with empathy and without anger. I should have said, Mindy, I realize that what you're doing is very important to you, but it's also very distracting while I'm trying to teach. If you could just wait until I'm finished, I'd really appreciate it. And if you do, I won't yell at you and make you cry. No, you leave out that part. I'm going to refer next to Ephesians 6, verse 4. Because when consequences are delivered with empathy, the focus is put on the behavior or misbehavior that led to those consequences, rather than getting all angry. And when consequences are delivered with anger, the focus is on the angry person delivering those consequences rather than the behavior itself. And that the behavior itself then is often forgotten. In Ephesians 6, verse 4, Paul says, "You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training." And that, by the way, is the Greek word paideuo. "And bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord." And again, in the New American Standard, it actually reads, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." Anger just provokes more anger. Remember Proverbs 15:1? A harsh word stirs up anger. And kids don't learn as well when they're angry. We might have to be stern. We might have to be forceful. But we have to control our anger. One of the parenting with love and logic tips that I get periodically by email came last March, and I'm going to read from it. It says, "The first rule of love and logic is that adults set limits without anger. This sounds like a wonderful rule in theory, but very often we find it difficult to avoid anger and associated behaviors when we are confronted with the many frustrating surprises of being a parent. avoiding anger, lectures, and other ineffective parenting practices is no simple task in today's hectic world. Like many parents, you might find that your biggest challenge is keeping your cool when your kids are getting on your last nerve. Why is it so important to remain as calm and collected as possible when we provide consequences for our children's misbehavior? A very important reason is that it allows us to deliver consequences with empathy. When parents allow their anger to build inside, they become too angry to think straight, and then they respond with the unhealthy, ineffective habits of lectures, threats, nagging, and repeated warnings. Fortunately, the following mental health practices can help us remain calm. And they give it three steps here. Step number one, create one calming statement, something to repeat to yourself when you feel like you're losing it. Everyone needs a calming thought to carry them as they navigate this not-so-calm world. Listed below are some examples of calming statements. I'll read through a few of them here. Anger makes it worse. Or, anger and frustration feed misbehavior. Or, frustration fuels the fire. Empathy instead of anger. My kids will someday select my nursing home. For me, when I was teaching, it was simply, Bruce, keep your cool. Keep your cool. Step number two, post your statement where you'll see it often. The more often you see your statement, the more likely it will pop into your head when your kids are getting on your last nerve. It's great for them to see it, too. I never posted that in my classroom. Step three, visualize yourself staying calm and using your statement. Each night as you are falling asleep, imagine yourself in a tough parenting situation with your children and handling it without breaking a sweat. Well, anyway, once we have the right goal, the right motive, and the right mindset, empathy, not anger, a fourth key to effective discipline is appropriate logical consequences. And it's not always easy to do this, but if standards have been set and a rule's been broken and corrective action needs to be taken, try to discipline in a manner commensurate with the infraction. Try to determine a punishment or corrective consequence that fits the crime. Although it's not as prevalent now, maybe because of child abuse laws, some parents in the past, even in the church, would spank their children for every infraction, no matter how serious. Whatever the infraction, the punishment was always the same, a paddling, a spanking. And these parents were determined not to be lenient, and their children were not going to be coddled, spoiled, undisciplined delinquents. They were not going to spare the rod and spoil the child. If two kids were using their mom's oven mittens to play catch out in the street with a gasoline-soaked tennis ball that had been lit on fire, that was worthy of a paddling. An actual event. And if my mother's listening in, it wasn't me. In fact, those individuals didn't get paddled. Parents never found out, but it would have been worthy of it. However, if two siblings were simply playing too loudly and woke up dad taking a nap, they were paddled for that too. There was no sense of proportion. But it was easier that way. Misbehave, paddle. And some parents would justify it by pointing to the rod of correction scriptures in the Bible. It's interesting to note, though, that we don't find any biblical examples of parents actually beating their children as a form of discipline or punishment. Not that punishment isn't can't be painful. But you don't see any examples of that. Discipline with appropriate logical consequences is not always easy. It requires thought, effort, and maybe even some advice from others. And if a child's caught misbehaving, and you can't think of a good consequence on the spot, it's okay to delay the consequences for a little while. Immediate consequences are usually better, but if a logical consequence does not come to mind, it's okay to say, "Ooh, this is really bad. This is really serious. Your mother and I are going to have to talk about this one. And but don't you worry about it. But there's going to be some consequences here, and we'll let you know. We'll let you know when we determine what they are. It's okay to do that. But then you got to make sure you follow through too. Sometimes though, discipline can be administered simply by not intervening in natural consequences of bad behavior. Don't necessarily rescue your kids from their mistakes. Mistakes, though, have to be what we call affordable mistakes. That is, the natural consequences will not affect long-term health or safety of the child. It has to be a consequence that has no irreversible negative effects. 4-year-old who recklessly crashes and breaks his tricycle in the lawn can suffer the natural disciplinary consequences of, well, there's no trike to ride now. That's an affordable mistake. And then mom and dad have to make sure they're not going to intervene and just buy a new one. If, however, that child rides his tricycle into the street, natural consequences of getting hit by a car, we consider those unaffordable. So a logical, artificial consequence might be to impound the tricycle for a significant amount of time. And it's good for kids to make a lot of affordable mistakes when they're young. Better that they learn a lesson about recklessly using their vehicles at age 4 than with a family car at age 17. I'm going to refer to a short familiar passage in Galatians 6, verse 7, because it backs up the core principle that when consequences are necessary, they should have some logical connection with the child's misbehavior or poor decision. Galatians 6, verse 7, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, he will also reap. Everything we do eventually catches up with us. And the sooner kids learn that, the better." Back in the early 1980s, I had a student, I'll call him Andy. Few of you have heard me tell this story before. Hope you don't mind hearing it again, because I have a little bit different perspective on it now than I did originally, and in fact, different perspective on it now than the last time I told it. Andy was a very good wrestler, and later the year that I had him in class, he won the Oregon State Wrestling Championship in his, I think it was 160 or 170-pound weight class. Unfortunately, he was not making a very good impression on me in my math class that I taught. He had a reputation as a hard worker, but he hadn't shown it much in my class. He was frequently talking when he should have been listening, and he didn't seem to take anything I said seriously. It was a little unusual because this was an upper-level, second-year algebra class, and I wasn't used to this kind of behavior from this type of student. And it seemed very disrespectful. Came to a point one week that I talked to him about it, and he reacted with kind of a, I don't need to listen to you attitude. I can learn this stuff on my own. You know, quit bothering me. Or at least that's the way I was reading his thinking. Probably shouldn't have been doing the mind reading there, but that's what I thought. And okay, I just got increasingly irritated with him, but I thought, just wait till the test comes for this. Just wait until he has to take this. Then he'll pay the price. Judgment will come. Punishment will be exacted. And on the day of the test, I was quite surprised. While nearly all the other students were working very diligently on that test, Andy was very nonchalant. It was a demanding test, but Andy would make a mark on his paper. He'd look up at the ceiling. He'd make another mark on his paper. He'd look over at the clock. And all the while, the rest of the students were scratching away furiously with their pencils. We didn't let them use calculators back then. But I watched Andy for a long time, but he continued this pattern of just making a mark and then kind of looking around the room. And I suspected he was trying to copy answers from other students, but I'd planned ahead. I thought this is going to be good punishment. I think he might try to cheat. So I said, Andy, go ahead, copy all the answers you want. And I was hoping he would, because I'd taken great pains to write up different versions of the test. They all appeared identical, but there were only minor modifications that resulted in a different answer for every problem. Then I carefully handed them out so that the student in front of him, the student to the right, to the left, and the one behind him, they all had different versions of the test than he did. And at the end of the period, I gathered up the tests and the answer sheets, and I was eager to run them through the grading machine. It was one of those multiple choice Scantron sheet things. You could correct them very quickly, and I wanted to see how poorly Andy had done. I was disappointed. Somehow, Andy managed to get a 96%. How could that be, I thought. He must have cheated somehow. I thought I'd planned for that. So I looked a little closer at his tests, and the tests of students who sat close to but not directly next to him. Let's see, was he able to see the test of the person up over here? Or up over here. So I checked those people, and sure enough, there was another test that had the same 96% score, and they even missed the same two problems, and they even put the same wrong answer to those problems. That did it for me. The odds of something like that happening by chance seemed extremely low, so I wrote on the test, "Andy, this is not your work. I have no choice but to give you a 0 for this test." I think I even wrote it in capital letters, you know, in red pen or red pencil, you know, real angry-looking letters. I was convinced Andy had cheated, and I was determined that punishment was done, justice would be done, and I was not going to let him get a 96 after being so arrogant and disrespectful. When I handed his test back to him, he reacted very indignantly. He loudly and vigorously denied having cheated and was very offended that I had even accused him of it. He even demanded to be given a retake test just to prove that he really did know the material. I refused. No way. I was certain he'd cheated, and I wanted to be sure he suffered the consequences, emphasis on suffered. Maybe I even felt the need for a little retribution. Besides, I thought, why should I have to go to all the trouble of writing up a retake test? Why should I have to sacrifice my time, my energy, just to give him a second chance? What if he did manage to do a respectable job on a retake test? And he would have avoided the full penalty of paying for his sin. There'd be no justice in a retake test. Andy needed to be punished. For the next few days in class, I felt a real strong attitude of resentment and hostility from him. He didn't say anything or do anything in particular, but his general atmosphere just poisoned the whole room. It made for a very unpleasant teaching environment. I was very irritated with him, and he seemed very irritated with me. Other students even started talking about it. Hey, did you hear about Mr. Hansen accusing Andy of cheating? Yeah, he should have gotten a 96, but Mr. Hansen gave him a 0. Teacher in the classroom next door to mine heard about the situation, and although she didn't question my judgment, actually maybe she did, she didn't say so, didn't question my judgment that I'd given a 0, she did suggest giving Andy a second chance. Write up a retake test for him, she said, but make it very difficult. Then make him come in after school in order to take it. That way he'll still have to suffer some consequences, some penalty for what he's done. She didn't put it exactly this way, but in a sense she was also saying, look at it from Andy's perspective and think about what would be best for him. With a retake, either he's got a chance to prove that he didn't cheat, or you're helping him come to grips with the fact that he did. Either way, it might help his relationship with you. I still protested, at least mentally. I was still in that stubborn one-size-fits-all discipline mode. Cheating deserves a 0. I didn't want to look at it from Andy's perspective. I didn't think about it then, but that would have been showing empathy, which I only recently discovered was such an important part of good discipline. Didn't think about it then. Anyway, I didn't want to take her advice, except that she happened to be my boss. She was the head of the math department. So I did. That afternoon, I searched through my files, and I found an old version of the same test. I'd stopped using it because it was far too difficult, so it's just what I needed. Next day, I called Andy up to my desk after class. I told him, Andy, I've changed my mind. Yes, I am willing to give you a second chance. I'll give you a retake. I was actually conciliatory, and without realizing it, I probably came across as empathetic. He was quite surprised and quickly agreed to stay after school for a retake test. So after school that day, Andy showed up in my empty room. I gave him the test, and he began working on it. As he did, I began to feel a little bit sorry for him. Test was so difficult that even a good student would have struggled with it. That's why I stopped using it. The thought even crossed my mind that maybe I was wrong. Maybe it wasn't all that improbable that two students could have missed the same two problems and even made the same common mistakes on those two problems. Maybe he did know the material. Maybe he hadn't cheated. Either way, Andy was under a lot of stress. Either he's being punished for something he didn't do, or he had cheated and he was trying to take a very difficult test with really nobody on his side to help him cope with a big mistake that he may have made. After only about 15 minutes, he got up from his seat and he began walking over to me. I knew the test would take a lot more than 15 minutes. So I expected him to complain that it was unfair to have him take a test that was so much more difficult than the one I had accused him of cheating on. And he would have had a valid point. Instead, he just handed it to me, said he'd done all he could, and he walked out the door. I began looking over the test, and as I suspected, he'd been completely frustrated by it. Only the few of the problems had even been attempted. But no sooner had I started checking them than the door opened, and he walked back into the room. Mr. Hansen, he said firmly, got something to say to you. He had a very sober look on his face. He said, you're exactly right. I did cheat on that test, and I feel very ashamed. I'm very sorry about it. I'm very sorry what I did, and I'll never, ever do it again. Then he walked towards me, and he stuck out his hand. Mr. Hansen, he said, and his voice began to crack. I apologize for any hard feelings between us, and I hope you'll forgive me. And he broke down, and he started to cry. I took his hand, and as he did, he reached out with the other hand, and he hugged me. I don't usually get too sentimental, but that affected me. I was impressed by Andy. It took some humility and courage for him to do what he did, to make that kind of admission like that. It took character. Character, huh? That's the goal of discipline, to grow in moral character. He learned from the experience, and so did I, especially as I look back on it 40 or so years ago. And there were things that I've learned more recently that I didn't learn back then and wish I had, the empathy part especially. So why was Andy acting out in class? Well, it turned out that he always struggled in math, and at some point he'd gotten a little lazy, he'd gotten behind, and pretty soon he was completely lost, but he was too ashamed to admit it. I think he was afraid of somebody telling him that perhaps he didn't deserve to be in that upper-level math class. But as it was, he began working hard in the class. He got caught up and survived the year with a C. The following year, he actually won an appointment to the Air Force Academy. Years later, I happened to run into his old wrestling coach who told me that Andy had gone on to become a teacher and was working in Central Oregon. And as I reflect back on it, it all turned out well. The goal of good discipline was accomplished, but mostly because I took some good advice and changed from my original discipline plan. I didn't think about it at the time, but my original motivation, was wrong. I was more interested in justice and punishment than I was in what was best for Andy. I did not consider the goal of discipline. I delivered the consequences without any empathy. And the disciplinary consequence of just giving him a zero was not the best fit for the situation. When I changed the plan and gave Andy a second chance, I had inadvertently applied the key elements of good discipline. Being a good disciplinarian is not easy. It can require time, effort, conscientious thought, outside advice, and even prayer. And even then, you probably won't do it perfectly. There are no perfect parents. However, if we're properly motivated by love, if we show empathy, not anger, and try to enforce consequences that are logically related to the mistake, it'll go a long way toward helping our young people achieve the goal of growing in godly moral character.